Before we get started, I just want to just make sure that you all know some relevant things about me. You all just heard some irrelevant things about me. There are some relevant things that you all should know about me. Most importantly, I grew up in the hood. I'm from the hood. And as they say, you know, you can take the boy out of the hood, but you can't take the hood out of the boy. So I am hood. That is relevant and important for you to know. And when I was growing up, you know, I engaged in some behaviors that society didn't find appropriate. I carried a gun, sold drugs, used drugs. You know, truth be told, by the time I was 17, I should have been either dead or in jail. But I'm not. I'm here before you. And I eventually turned my life around, if you will, to some extent, in that I got, please don't applaud that, please. That is not something to applaud. Because there are cats who are engaged in that behavior and probably should be, given the options that they have. So that's not to be applauded. Now, I got serious about my formal education. And I got serious such that I earned a PhD in neuroscience. And that changed my trajectory and maybe saved my life, maybe. But as I studied neuroscience, and I studied neuroscience specifically because I wanted to solve the drug addiction problem. You see, I thought that the poverty and the crime in the hood was a direct result of drugs like crack cocaine. So I reasoned that if I could cure drug addiction, then I could fix the poverty and the crime in my community. But more than 25 years later, I stand before you and I now realize that neuroscience alone, or any other sort of health or medical perspective alone, is insufficient to deal with the problems that I just described, some of those problems. Now, I came to this conclusion while writing my book, High Price. And for the book, I interviewed relatives and friends from back in the day. One of these interviews were particularly poignant and pertinent to this discussion. It was with my cousin Louis. Growing up, he and I, we shared a bed at my grandmother's. And as a kid, he was a math whiz. He's the one who actually sharpened my math skills. Now he lived in a halfway house in Fort Lauderdale. And it had been nearly 30 years since I had saw him last. Now, I was horrified by his appearance. He stood about 6 feet, but weighed at most 110 pounds, his face drawn and emaciated. And his few remaining teeth looked like they were on their way out. My shock turned to profound sadness, but I only showed him that I was happy to see him because I didn't want to make him feel, but wanted to make him feel bad. A benefit and a drawback of my decades in science is that I have become a master at masking my emotions. Now, this skill was seriously being tested as Louis stood before me. We slapped hands, embraced, and without interruption, Louis talked the next hour. He talked about the various crimes he had committed over the years and the amount of money that he had stolen and stashed. I learned that the police had beaten him up on many occasions. He contemplated whether he had done the right thing by not becoming an informant. Quote, he said, I should have dropped dime on him. But at the same time, he was proud of not having become, quote, a bitch-ass snitch, end quote. Louis' thoughts were disjointed and difficult to follow. He jumped from one subject to another without a break or transition. He paced around this little small yard the entire time I was there. His involuntary, repetitive movements were a textbook case of tardive dyskinesia brought on by taking antipsychotic medication for more than 2 decades. Although the details aren't clear, family lore has it that he was initially put on these medications in the ER after having a, quote, bad reaction to some unknown street drug. And when he was sent to prison, they kept him on these in order to keep him obedient and calm. You know, a chemical straitjacket, a chemically induced prison, if you will. In graduate school, I learned quite a bit about antipsychotics and what they were used for. These were the drugs used to treat schizophrenia and related illnesses. The simplistic idea is that psychotic behaviors that, such as those seen in schizophrenics, are caused by overactivation of dopamine cells in the midbrain. Antipsychotic drugs block dopamine receptors and thereby prevent excessive dopamine activity. Behaviorally, these drugs quiet the voices in the heads of schizophrenics and reduce the paranoia and agitation. The problem is this. Some of these medications, the type that my cousin Louis was on, block dopamine receptors so extensively that the brain compensates by increasing the density of dopamine receptors. The brain is now hypersensitive to dopamine, and after years of treatment, the person develops tardive dyskinesia and becomes even more susceptible to psychotic symptoms. In other words, the treatment for psychotic symptoms can actually cause these symptoms. You see, it's a trap. It's a chemically induced one, but it's a trap. With each passing minute, Louis's voice became background noise, and I felt more and more grief and despair. I wondered how this had happened, but already knew, because I had seen other male loved ones have similar stories. Virtually all of them had been initially caught up in the system via drug charge while in their teens or early 20s, and that began a vicious cycle from which they couldn't escape. The skills that sustains people throughout life are usually obtained during young adulthood. This is a critical period. I, for example, spent most of my young adult years in classrooms, in labs, learning how to think and how to write and how to be non-threatening and how to be white. These skills have allowed me to support my family financially. As a result, I have a stake in this sick-ass society. Now, as a side note, I just want to say we are now in our society talking about Black Lives Matter. And so young people, young Black people kind of came up with this slogan, much to their credit, proclaiming to the society that their life matters. But I'd like to say that anytime you have to proclaim to your society that your life matters, it means that your government has failed you. Your leaders have failed you. Your fellow citizens have failed you. But I'm trying to talk about my cousin Louis, so let me get back to Louis. So in contrast to so many of the Black boys with who I might grew up, they didn't have a chance to claim their stake in society. They didn't acquire the skills, the necessary skills, and didn't get the needed support during the critical period. Instead, they were under the supervision of a system that doesn't seem to understand or care about the importance of having Black people being invested in this society. Supporters of this system have an irrational focus on eliminating certain drugs and are preoccupied with those who violate drug laws, especially if they are Black. Selective enforcement of drug laws, in effect, serves as a tool to marginalize Black males, especially, and to keep them in this vicious cycle of incarceration and isolation from mainstream. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not arguing or suggesting that people should not be sanctioned for legal infractions. I am not. Because there are many cases when sanctions are appropriate. However, the penalty should not be so severe that the penalized young person is unable to recover and stake a claim in the society. In such cases, we all lose. And with no real stake in the larger society, many of my relatives and back in the day friends feel they have nothing more to lose. And as my favorite writer, James Baldwin, so poignantly and eloquently put it, quote, "The most dangerous creation of any society is the man who has nothing to lose," end quote. As my time with Louis was drawing to an end, I was reminded of the days when we were kids climbing the huge tree in my grandmother's yard. "Don't go too high," he would say. He was a year older and felt compelled to look after me to make sure that I didn't step on a weak branch and fall. After saying goodbye to Louis, I sat in the car and cried because I felt as though I had failed to look after him as he had done for me when we were kids. Prior to writing this book, I hadn't cried since I was a child. Now, I sat in the car, a flood of tears came down. I thought about all the other Louis who we had failed to look after. I thought about all the years I had spent away from my Florida family in order to pursue an education, to obtain a PhD in neuroscience that is clearly inadequate to help solve the problems that they face. The tears continued streaming down as I thought about the tremendous promise that Louis had once showed. He certainly showed more potential than I had as children. After a few minutes, I gathered myself and started the car. Johnny Cash was on the radio singing, "There'll be peace in the valley for me, dear Lord, I pray." And I slowly drove away. Now, as I think about Louis' story, I think that it's emblematic of the larger drug policy issue. For me, it raises the question of what does humane drug policy look like? How many people, I know that many people here are comfortable with the popular refrain, "Treatment, not jail," or a public health perspective and not a law enforcement approach. I know many people in the room are comfortable with that. But I'm here to tell you that the treatment and or public health approach is equally flawed. Many physicians, treatment providers, scientists like myself, and public health officials are just as incompetent and ignorant about drugs as law enforcement personnel. And besides, the majority of us who use drugs don't need your help, don't need you. Consider another behavior in which humans engage for pleasure, sexual intercourse. Now, sex is certainly potentially dangerous, and people certainly can die from sexually transmitted illnesses. It's true that we might seek medical attention if we have contracted a sexually transmitted infection. That's true. But the vast majority of us don't. And the vast majority of us don't go to a physician seeking advice about how to perform better sexually. Well, some of you probably should, but the vast majority don't. But I'm trying to make the point that most people who use drugs do not need to be treated medically. They need to be treated humanely.
Right.
We need a human rights approach. And some people will say, well, what does that mean? What does it mean? Well, first we must acknowledge that we as a society have exaggerated the harmful effects of drugs for so long that it has created a moral and credibility vacuum. We have none.
That's right.
We have lied for so long, and we continue to lie about the dangers of drugs. Let me just give you me as an example. For the past 25 years or so, I have been studying drugs as part of my research. I actually give drugs to people. I have given thousands of doses of drugs like crack cocaine, marijuana, methamphetamine to people. And I have concluded in published accounts in the finest medical journals that these drugs produce predictable effects and can be safely used by humans to enhance human function.
Yes.
Of course, there are potential harms, as there are with any drugs, including aspirin or alcohol. But we know how to minimize these harms, and we also know how to enhance the potential positive effects. So after all of my years of studying drugs, I have concluded that the most humane approach is legal regulation of recreational drugs. Mm. Now, I should say this is a departure from High Price, and it's also a departure from my previous public appearances and statements. So it requires some sort of clarification or better understanding. So why have I once argued for decriminalization of all drugs, just like they do in Portugal, just like they do in the Czech Republic, where they have better sort of, they perform better than us on all of the major drug use indicators. Now, this is a departure from that position. This is now, I'm moving to complete legal drug regulation. That's what's needed, and I need to tell you why. But first, I have to tell you the difference between decriminalization and legalization. Decriminalization is like treating drug possession like a traffic violation. If someone is caught possessing drugs, certain amounts, rather than incarcerate them, or rather than them receiving a criminal penalty, they receive what equates to be a traffic violation, a fine of no more than, let's say, $100 or so. Legal drug regulation is what we do with alcohol, what we do with tobacco. These products must be sold as a result of meeting certain requirements. So you can't, they're sold in, as we know how we sell alcohol, people must be 21 in order to purchase alcohol, or 18 to purchase tobacco. So that's legal regulation. Now, one of the major reasons that I have gone to the position that I have gone to is this. With decriminalization, we don't touch drug adulterations. So the major concern with illicit or recreational or street drugs are the adulterants. A drug like cocaine, for example, around the country contains this compound or this agent called levamisole, which is an animal dewormer. And it decreases what white blood cells and increases the likelihood that you might get an infection. It can cause death at really high doses. The concern is not so much the cocaine, but the concern is the levamisole. The same is true with other drugs. We worry about the adulterants. Decriminalization does not touch adulterants. Legal regulation of the market will ensure that we have pure drugs, unadulterated drugs. It will also provide dosing, appropriate packaging, such that we sell at certain dosages, and we don't sell at doses that are too high, or doses that will get people in trouble. So unit doses we can control with drug regulation. We can't do that with decriminalization. And another reason that, and a more important reason that I have moved away from drug decriminalization is that drug decriminalization still gives considerable discretion to local law enforcement officials, police officers. They can still arrest people or fine people. If we learn nothing from Ferguson, we learned how the Ferguson Police Department makes money off of these fines. That sort of thing can still happen under decriminalization. In fact, it happens in New York City. In 1977, New York decriminalized marijuana. But we all know that there today, 80 to 90% of the people who are arrested for marijuana-related charges are Black and Latino, even though the drug is decriminalized. So with legal regulation, you decrease some of the discretion of local law enforcement. And that's a major sort of concern that I have. I have a major concern as long as our society remains as sick as it is, as long as we continue to allow people to engage in racial discrimination officially. Drug prosecution or drug law enforcement will continue to be used as a tool to further marginalize this group. So this is the major reason that I am moving away from decriminalization to drug legalization. And the most important reason that I am moving away is that I'm a drug expert. I have given thousands of doses of these drugs to people. And I know that they can be used safely. In fact, I use them myself. I know that they can be used safely. And I know I can teach others how to use them safely and keep people, I know how to enhance people's function. But we have to be honest and share with the public what we've learned. And on that note, I suspect I will have questions, and I'd like to thank you for your time.